3 ppb. Atmospheric methane levels averaged 1,895.7 ppb during 2021, or around 162% greater than pre-industrial levels. From NOAA's observations, scientists estimate global methane emissions in 2021 are 15% higher than the 1984 to 2006 period. Meanwhile, levels of carbon dioxide also continue to increase at historically high levels. The global surface average for carbon dioxide during 2021 was 414.7 parts per million, which is an increase of 2.66 ppm over the 2020 average. This marks the 10th consecutive year that carbon dioxide increased by more than 2 parts per million, which represents the fastest sustained rate of increase in 63 years since monitoring began. Scientists fear soaring concentrations of methane, which is up to 87 times more potent than CO2 over a 20-year period, may have triggered a potentially irreversible climate feed loop. Critics call the 30% target a step in the right direction, but insufficient to adequately address the emissions crisis. The International Energy Agency said last October that a 75% reduction in methane emissions by 2030 is essential to combating the climate emergency.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of Back to Reality. In the realm of truth, we have two very dear guests. Now I want them to introduce themselves to you. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum, I'm Muzaffar Haider from the UK and I'm studying in the holy city of Qom, alhamdulillah.
Such a pleasure to be with you. So you're studying religion?
Yeah, I'm studying in the Hawza.
Yes.
I'm Sadiqa from the UK as well, and I'm studying in Qom as well in the Sisters Hawza. And my field of study is fiqh and usul, one more term left.
Oh,
and,
very great. So just for those audience and listeners who do not know what is fiqh and usul, can you please tell us a little bit about your area of study?
So
what do you do?
Fiqh and usul is basically the principles of jurisprudence. So we look at every marja taqlid has a book of laws. How do they derive those laws?
And now we go to another word, marja taqlid.
Marja taqlid. Every Shia would choose
a scholar to follow
in their daily ahkam rules, in the daily rules, such as with different parts of ahkam, religious rulings. I also study how they're derived. You have different subjects within fiqh and usul, within the principles of jurisprudence. And we look at the different principles, how those principles are derived, how the laws are derived, the hadith and the Quran related to those laws, which basically comes down to the nitty-gritty of your ahkam.
So plenty laws. Much of delicate things to study.
There's a lot of attention to detail, yes.
Yes, exactly, details. So wish you best of luck.
Thank you.
I hope you do well in that major. Now, let's go to the heart of our discussion. For today's Back to Reality. Here's the thing, 5 minutes after we're being born, everything has been given to us. We have no choice over where we live, where we have been born, our nationality, our parents, many things, right?
Yes, definitely.
But how does it feel?
Well, it's a necessity.
It's weird.
It's not, because we live in a world where if you don't have a nationality,
mm-hmm.
the nationality of a person also comes down to the fact that those laws of the country now apply to that person, even if they're 1 minute old.
Mm-hmm.
Every person has rights, and those rights have to be abided by.
It seems like you were satisfied where you have been born, in what family you have been born.
No, because we are born, but we are the ones who have to carve out our future as well. Just being born in a specific mm-hmm. place does not hurt a person, rather.
As but it can change many things in their future.
Our futures, yes, they can change, but everything is not, it's not all of our lives are predetermined.
Mm-hmm.
We have free will of how we go ahead. So yes, I might have been born in a specific family, but how I move ahead is down to me. It's not down
it's
to my family.
That is the part which is related to free will. Brother Muzaffar.
I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. 5 minutes after I was born, I don't remember a thing. So I wouldn't be able to.
You don't remember, but now we can know.
I wouldn't
know.
Be able to elaborate on how I felt at those labels being slapped onto
mm-hmm.
me and being given my name and everything.
Perhaps 15 years later, you understood what you have been through.
Yeah, I'm still thinking about it, though. Yeah.
Yes.
There are things.
Many people, you know, they're not satisfied with the place they have been born. The setting, you know, everything has been set for us. We come into it and we can change maybe some specific things.
It goes back to, I think it was Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam or Imam Ridha alayhi salam. But he was asked at a very young age, he must have been like 10 years old, maybe younger.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked by the Taghut of the time, how much free will do we have and how much, you know, predestination is involved in our life? And he said, stand on one leg. And he stood on one leg. And then he said, now raise the other leg as well. And he said, I can't. He said, it's like this.
Wasn't that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam?
I remember it being Imam Musa al-Kadhim. Let's just say alayhi salam. And so, yeah, it's almost 50-50. You could argue that.
Mm-hmm.
There is an element that is tying you down to earth. You can't avoid that. You are going to be given your name at birth. You're going to be given, which of course you can change later on, by the way, in life, right?
Yes, but you have to grow very old.
How you
to
look, your genetics.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things are going to be, even your personality, by the way.
Yes, they say that they come through genes.
Right, genes and a number of other factors.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that some people are interested in zodiac and things like this. But at the end of the day, personality itself, which is something that people would not like to hear.
But also that is affected by the place you have been born in.
Your personality? No,
yes,
I mean
the
innate, the fitra. The fitra
mm-hmm.
of that personality, right? So that is not going to change.
Explain the word fitra for us.
Right. So the fitra is, let's translate it as the divine innate nature of a human being. Okay.
Shall we call it the unconscious?
No, I wouldn't. Everybody has a subconscious, right?
Yeah.
The subconscious mind is just like this bank where you can, it's just a store place where
mm-hmm.
you keep all sorts of thoughts and images
yes.
everything goes into it. It's like a big storeroom. But
so, you
definitely,
know, in psychology, we had something that was called collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I read things about that, I remembered the word fitra.
Alhamdulillah.
You know, because that is very close to it. You know, they say all the human beings have got a history that is buried back in their brain.
Yeah.
We all are the same in that point.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
The discussion of what the fitra is a lengthy discussion in
yes,
of
exactly.
itself. We have a verse
and
in the Quran about it.
We don't want to go away from what
we're
talking about.
Yeah, coming back
now.
To the idea that, look, there are certain things that you don't have control over.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is not that you want to control those. The idea is that you become, first of all, satisfied. You understand the decree of Allah is such that, yes, I was born into certain circumstances
yes.
with a certain background, into a certain family, into a certain climate and culture. Now, what am I going to do with it?
So that is that count.
That's what really counts,
yes.
right? That's what really matters. What you do with what you were born
mm-hmm.
with.
Yes. So now, sister, we have been born into a setting that has been predetermined for us. Now, what can I do to change the rest? You know, I have been surrounded by an environment, by people that have been predetermined for me. Now I want to change it. I'm talking about free will. I mean, because many people might say, these are all, you know, the naturalistic people, usually he called it, the thing that is going to determine our future is the environment that we are living in, which is the nature that we're living in, and then the genes, the biology that I have been born with. Now, if we want to describe on free will, what will we say? If we consider that the place that I've been born has been decided for me, people around me have been decided for me, how shall I call myself a person with free will?
First, the family we are born with, mm-hmm. yes, it's been determined for us, but not those around us. We have the choice of who we choose as friends. Mm-hmm. We have the choice of who we associate ourselves with. These are not determined for us. These are free will. This is how I choose to go ahead in life. Mm-hmm. If I choose a friend who's into drugs and alcohol, that's my fault.
But don't you think that also is related to the family I was born in?
No, again, it comes down to free will. A lot of the times we have the option of choosing what to do. It may be we may make a mistake in what we choose, but that does not mean that we don't have free will. It's just mm-hmm. a mistake that I made the wrong choice. Family, yes, sometimes. But again, with family as well, today we live in a very vast world where I come from the UK and you have social services, you have shelters for different people. Mm-hmm. If I may be born in a family that doesn't look after me, there are ways for me to find a path out of it. Yes, maybe not in the initial years of my life, mm-hmm. but as we grow up, we can separate ourselves from these dangerous values that may come from our environment.
So you mean that our choices comes after the things that have been decided for us? The thing that is important is the things that we are going to choose in future.
Well, initially in the first 5-7 years of our lives, mm-hmm. we don't know the difference between right and wrong, mm-hmm. right? But after the age of 7, the consciousness starts to come in. The ability to differentiate between right and wrong comes in, and it is part of our fitrah as well. That might be at a lower level for a very young child, but as we grow up, the innate nature does start to strengthen because we start to get acquainted with the world around us.
Exactly.
If you look at something as simple as alcohol, right? We are talking about, if we go back to someone choosing a friend who's into drugs and alcohol. Even those who drink alcohol are very well aware that it is harmful for them. They still do it out of choice. And in the many documentaries, if you go to see that, look into these issues.
But you know, the place they are living in and the people that they have been growing with sort of pushed them into that direction.
We have many examples in the world that goes against this. You have many people who come from very bad neighborhoods who grew up to be perfectly good mm-hmm. people. They did not let the environment pull them down. Yes. There's a difference between allowing ourselves to go ahead with that environment or pulling ourselves out of that situation.
Yes,
it is harder than it would be for me and you who have grown up in, alhamdulillah, very pious families.
Yes, good situation.
But that doesn't mean that it's impossible. We can't mm-hmm. say it's impossible. It might be harder, but that does not mean they can't get themselves out of it.
Yes, and it's not impossible, but it's harder.
Yes, I'm not going to pull them down because they have got into that situation, perhaps because they got the wrong upbringing. Mm-hmm. But again, I stand by my point that they can get themselves out of that situation with the help that you get in the world. There's a lot of information that goes around today, and mm-hmm. the very few people who can say that today they don't have access to the internet or they don't have access to services around the world that help people pull themselves out of disadvantaged situations.
So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
How how is it fair that a person living in a bad country that is surrounded with too much of war and bad events, how shall we call it fair that a person who is living in a bad situation is going to be judged the same way as the other person who's been living in a country that is fulfilling and everything is very peachy and pinky?
Well, the short answer is they're not going to be judged in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Allah is the most just. As well as that, he's the most merciful. What Allah is going to do is judge everyone as per the situation that they
were in, right? Thing that I want to hear.
There might be one person like us who were born into a Muslim family. We were born into a household that had the Quran on the shelf, right? And we always had some sort of semblance to Islam throughout our family. Allah is going to ask us on Judgment Day, what did you do with what I gave you? I gave you the Quran. I gave you the pristine examples of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. What did you do with that? Right? And there might be one Tom who just lives his life like that and then he commits suicide at the end of it. That's the end of his life. There might be another Tom who realizes that this is wrong. He doesn't necessarily the Christian understanding of what God is to
just
bring iman upon that, right? That struggle is what Allah is going to reward him with. We should not be surprised on the Day of Judgment if that Tom has a higher status than many of us born into Muslim households.
Yes, yes.
Right? Because our struggle with what we were given was far less compared to the struggle
Tom. Exactly. Now, we are giving a specific situation and God is the fairest of all. He's going to judge us based on whatever he has given us. And also, as the sister mentioned, we have a free will of choosing the other people that are going to come into our lives. So this was the whole time that we had for today's episode. Thank you for listening to us. Until another session, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing A Revolution in Four Seasons, directed by Jesse Dieter. And joining me in the studio, we have Carol Allen, who writes for CloseUpFilm.com, Movies One, and is an editor and film critic for AEA Digest. And beside her is Catherine Shakhdam, who is a political analyst and director of the Shakhfakhner Institute of Middle Eastern Studies. Now, A Revolution in Four Seasons tells the story of two women with opposing political views fighting for different futures in Tunisia, the country that sparked the Arab Spring. Though, as this documentary shows, there are many unexpected challenges that lay ahead in trying to fight for a better future for your country.
We can little by little show the drawbacks of drinking alcohol, the drawbacks of wearing bikini.
I was the first person from this village to be elected in the parliament.
Our people are waiting us to start writing the constitution.
They wrote one article of the constitution.
There's a change since the revolution. Now the Tunisian society is divided.
I could have been in the United States. But you put me in Tunisia because you have this crazy idea that this country can be a democracy.
And welcome both of you to the show. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on. And so this documentary takes you on a journey into the lives of two very different Tunisian women, and who both embrace the revolution but have completely different visions for the future of their country. Carol, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on A Revolution in Four Seasons?
Well, it was interesting and important to see the world of two women from a very different country, as I said, very different point of view, with whom we have more in common than we might think. I don't want to go too far ahead, but at one point, for example, both of them get married, they have their first babies, they both have to cope with a problem which is universal for women throughout the world. How do you have your place in the world and still fulfill your duties as a wife and mother? And interestingly, it is Jawara, the more conventionally Muslim lady, who solves it most easily in that she is involved in politics. She's a member of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the Constitution. Sorry, and her husband, he helps her a lot. The other woman, Emna,
who's a secularist in the film.
She is a secularist. Well, she is a Muslim, I think, in that she observes the fasting rules, but she doesn't wear the hijab.
Right. Which is she wants to see a difference between religion and the rule of the country.
Yes, she wants a more she wants, as it says in the trailer, a state which is like Sweden or France, mm-hmm. whereas the other lady is a member of the Islamic Democratic Party, mm-hmm. and she wants an Islamic state which is still democratic. Which is a concept we in the West probably find quite difficult because we tend to think Islamic, and we're very wary of it. So it was a very positive film from that point of view.
And quite refreshing to see that.
Yeah, Jawara, she really impressed me. I thought she was she's a lovely, intelligent, thoughtful woman. She's not a scary Islamist at all. I'd like her to be my friend.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in here. What was your take on the documentary?
I found it very interesting. I mean, to be fair with you, I didn't expect that I would actually enjoy it because, you know, I thought it was going to be one of those, you know, movie on the so-called Arab Spring. But what I found particularly interesting is that you have those two women who, you know, at the beginning of the documentary, you expect to be kind of, you know, on the opposite side of the river, I would say. They're actually quite similar in their hope for Tunisia, which is essentially to empower the people and have a system that represents, you know, the people but doesn't betray, you know, their identity. And I think that, you know, the issue here is really identity, is how does, you know, an Islamic or self-identified Islamic country find itself, you know, not just within the region, but within, you know, I would say, you know, this desire to be democratic and this desire to function, you know, within the international community.
Mm-hmm. It is an interesting point that this documentary raises, that democracy is different for different people.
Exactly.
And has different interpretations.
I think for me that was the core issue that, you know, it's maybe not talked about, but it's there, where, you know, you have, you know, someone who wants to have a secular democracy, you know, like France, where, you know, the state and religion are quite separate, which is fine. And then, you know, you have the other point of view where she talks a lot about, you know, identity, how not to betray your heritage and your tradition. I think this is something that hasn't been talked about, this necessity for the Islamic world to actually have a democracy that looks like them, mm-hmm. rather than looks like a Western democracy. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that there are more than just one way to be democratic. I don't think they're that different. I think they're very different in their approach to democracy or how they would like to formulate it, but they come across the same issues where, you know, secularism is really good on paper to some extent, but then there's issue attached to that. And then the same thing when it comes to Islamism, where, you know, there was a lot of issue. I mean, when you talk about terrorism, for example, or how there was this...
Actually, we're going to touch that on that a bit later on.
When you think that in order for me to be a progressive, I have to look like the Western people, to eat like them, to think like them, to have the same taste. This harms not only our identity, but the human identity itself. You cannot be just a subordinate to France or to the United States and forget about your religion, forget about your history, forget about your language, even your language, in order to be just to be progressive, I think.
Carol, you mentioned a bit earlier how you were surprised to see, as a Westerner, a Muslim woman, a strong Muslim woman, getting involved in politics. And she also has a strong family life, and her husband stays at home. What was this like watching this for you?
Well, as I said earlier, it was a bit of an eye-opener. I mean, that particular point you raised there about the political woman who is well supported by her Muslim husband, whereas the French-speaking woman who wants to be who wants to be like Sweden or France, her husband, who has spent a lot of time in America, behaves pretty much like a Western bloke. He goes into politics and leaves her at home holding the baby, you know, with her life on hold.
And you can see their relationship became strained, whereas yes. The others didn't.
Yes. It is actually very good PR for the idea of an Islamic state which is not repressive and which can be democratic. In fact, the clip we just saw was reiterating the points that Catherine just made.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, what do you think? Do you think this documentary shows the positive side of Muslims?
Well, it shows definitely that, first of all, number one, there is a space for women in politics and Islam. So this is not, you know, the two don't have to clash. And, you know, this idea that, for example, that women should not enter politics, I think is linked to, you know, Wahhabism, Salafism, radical Islam, basically, where it's Islam is being deconceptualized. It's taken away from its context, and it doesn't mean anything anymore. But what you see here is very interesting, because she's hammering on the idea of identity. And again, I think that it's, you know, we need to listen to what she's saying, because it's just, you know, it's a neo-colonial reaction, I would say, where, you know, whether she's right or wrong, there is this idea that the West is trying to impose a certain socio-political model, and there's a reaction against it, because people want to find their own way through democracy. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we want to have a real discussion on how we move forward in the Middle East, how we could enable and accompany those countries to actually find, you know, their way and be democratic, we have to make sure that we don't impose any particular model. And, you know, if you look at Iran, for example, which is I know that people will say, no, it's not, but it is a very progressive society. I think it's a perfect example of that, where it doesn't feel the constraint of colonialism. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be to identify itself against it. And I think that's what you see in Tunisia, is that Tunisia was, you know, recently freed or independent from France. And yet you see how France is very much, you know, impacting the way that they think themselves forward in politics. And, you know, I think that the Islamist tapped into it, reacted against it, and somehow, I would say, you know, played it to their advantage. So it was a very good PR exercise, as you mentioned. But of course, you know, some of them were genuine, some of them less so. And so, you know, we saw the abuses that it led to. But again, I'm going to say that, for example, it took France 5 republics, 2 empires, and a failed monarchy to finally be a democracy. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to give it time. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to understand that you don't become a democratic state overnight.
I think, yeah, we're going to discuss more the future and the problems of the country that it faced.
The goal is to train community organizers. We believe that it's very important to have independent representatives in the Constituent Assembly elections. We're doing it Obama style, actually, here, you know, grassroots movement.
So I'd like to talk about the secularist movement in the documentary. There was Emna, who was supporting a secular country for Tunisia. And Carol, what are some of the struggles that she faced in the pursuit of power?
Some of the struggles that she faces? Her chief campaign seems to be, her chief issue seems to be with the police, who don't appear to be democratic at all. And this is, you know, this is something which is not just a problem in Tunisia. The personal issues I mentioned earlier about coping with being a person, an effective person in the outside world, and with her baby. I actually found her, I have to admit, a less interesting character than Johara.
Really? Why is that?
But what is interesting as well, I knew very little about the history of Tunisia, really, until the Arab Spring happened. Again, an eye-opener for Westerners is we tend to think an Islamic state is going to be repressive, a secular state isn't. Well, in this instance, the dictator Ben Ali, was it?
Yes.
He was a secularist. And when we come to the elections, the fear is that the secular party is going to bring back another dictator. So the points that Catherine was making earlier about not imposing our view, our Western view of democracy, on other countries is very important, because we do tend to think, well, we've got it right. In the case of Britain, we had an empire, we had colonies, we know how to run things. And you actually have to respect what is there. It's quite natural for human beings to want more independence, to want a more democratic state. But I think they have to find their own way of doing it. And it rather looks like Tunisia is doing this now.
Do you think it's in a better state now? I mean, do you get a sense from the documentary that before the revolution it was in a bad state?
I get the sense from the documentary. I'm not always clear from the documentary what exactly was going on in Tunisia before. For example, Johara refers to the fact that women have had the vote for a long time. Then we get a caption with the first lot of elections in the documentary. This is the first time there have been free elections ever in this country. I know, can you explain that?
Yes, I'm going to ask Catherine, Could you give us
Women were given, you know, the right to vote. I can't remember when. It was quite early on. I think it was the 1950s or something, because of France. And then, you know, when Tunisia became independent, it kind of carried on. And as you mentioned, Ben Ali was very, I would say, you know, secular, very progressive, at least, you know, by France's standards, and which is why he was, you know, quite well liked by the French government. There's a difference in between, you know, where all people can vote and they actually have a right to say something. And I think this is the problem here, is that it's not because you live in a secular, you know, republic, for example, that you actually have a say in anything. And I think that's what they refer to. And the sad thing is that I get the sense that, you know, somehow both of them felt that their revolution, you know, the way that they imagined themselves to become free, was taken away from them, you know, for different reasons. So, you know, secularism didn't happen the way Emna wanted. And then, you know, for the other lady, it's, you know, she felt, I think, betrayed by this move towards, you know, radicalism, where there was an imposition of certain views, where she hoped that it was more an invitation to. And I think this is the main problem here.
And I wanted to mention another part in the documentary where Johara gave a powerful speech in Parliament talking about how they have to smash the stereotypes and work together. What did you make of that scene?
I admired the power of her speech. That wasn't the scene that made the biggest impression on me, though. One that did, which is, again, very important to the image of Islam in the West, was at the end, towards the end, because terrorism isn't mentioned very much in the film, although I understand it is a problem that there was...
Both facing the Muslims and the secularists.
Yeah,
the isn't the Muslim problem?
Indeed. But there is a terrorist incident towards the end of the film, and Johara says, this is awful, this is not what my father taught me, this is not what is in the Quran, we must fight it.
Terrorism is in the heart of the capital, it's in Bardo, it's in the museum, next to the parliament. And especially I was there as a deputy, and I was there as an ordinary citizen. This is not the Islam I belong to. This is not the Islam that my father teaches me. And this is not the Islam that I read in the Quran. I can't read any verse in the Quran that justifying what they are doing now. It's a religion which preaches tolerance, which preaches peace. Then we have to fight them.
That was a really moving moment in the documentary, that fight for struggle. I mean, you get the sense that the revolution was in fact the easy part and the problem lies in rebuilding the country. Is that the impression you got also?
Yes, and isn't that always the problem with revolutions? You know, it's all very well to tear something down, but then you have to find the right way of building something up. And another point that lady made earlier in the film was the difficulty of reconciling being an idealist with being a politician. And that, again, is another universal point that she's making there.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's a very human story that this documentary tells also. And so 6 years on, Catherine, from the Arab Spring, what problems still persist in the country? We saw briefly there was an issue of terrorism.
Yeah. Well, I think Tunisia, interestingly enough, I mean, started it off. And it's a blueprint for that, you know, it's a compounding of everything. All the issues that, you know, other countries in the Middle East are facing right now, which is terrorism, you know, the discussion to, you know, secularism, Islamism, what do we do? Could we find, you know, another way? And, you know, I think her silence, you know, speaks volume, really. And it's really moving, because what do you say in the face of you know, radicalism. What do you say before terrorism? Terrorism doesn't speak for any religion. So, you know, here it's Islam, but, you know, it could be Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, it doesn't matter. There is no religion that, you know, preaches, you know, violence. It's just ludicrous. It's a political construct. And I think that what you have here is the desire, you know, is this attempt to have pluralism. And this is what I heard, you know, throughout the documentary.
Acceptance and tolerance.
Yes, that people need to find a way to live together, to find a way to disagree, but not hate each other. You can hate each other's ideas. It doesn't mean you have to hate each other and enact on that hatred. And I think this is the main issue that you have, is that people have been taught, for whatever reason, that they live to live in this kind of binary construct where they have to be either, you know, on this side or that side, hate each other, love each other. It doesn't have to be this way. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that a lot has to do with the way that the revolution was spoken out in the media, you know, that kind of imprinted this idea again that they have to be against each other. Clearly, mm-hmm. those two women have very similar paths. You know, even like I said, they're sitting on different sides of the mm-hmm. river, but again, they're facing the same challenges. They just approach them differently.
And Carol, would you agree? Is there a lot of misinformation in the mainstream media?
I think there probably is. Of course, I'm not in a position to know what's false and what's not, but yes, Catherine is absolutely right when she says that we can live together with different viewpoints. I hate what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. And that's what we need to actually get, not just in Tunisia and not just mm-hmm. in the UK, but throughout the world.
And this is one of the most powerful messages you get from the documentary.
Yes, yes.
So we're nearing the end of the film, this programme now, and I'm just wondering, what would you have liked to see in the documentary also?
What would I... well, I would have liked a little bit more explanation of the context. I got a little bit confused. I was very aware there was a Democratic Islamic Party because Juwara was part of it. They were taking a heck of a long time over writing the constitution, somebody pointed out. A bit like Brexit, really. and then suddenly when the president, obviously the prime minister, I can't remember, decided to cede and say, OK, we'll have another election, suddenly the constitution was in place. I didn't realise how quickly that could be. So there were certain things about clarity which I would
criticise. Would you recommend the film, Final 30 Seconds to
Oh,
you?
Yes, I'd be very interested. It's American. I don't know where it's been shown in America. It's a sort of film that might crop up on BBC 4 or Channel 4 or something here. And I think it would be an interesting one for us all to watch.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much, ladies, for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thanks to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. In a hard war, one cannot fight with the use of old weapons. The hardware parts of the issue are accessible, but the important part is the software one. The weapon of clarification contains an important software part. There is a room for innovation, new ideas, and new methods in this area. In my opinion, what can function as an efficient weapon today is the clarification of lofty Islamic values in different areas. There are many things to be said in the area of ideological and religious matters. We have many attractive and delightful ideas for the world. There are many things that have been left unsaid in matters related to Islamic lifestyle. Examples include Islamic viewpoints on the environment, treatment of animals and family. These things constitute lifestyle. Islam has many attractive ideas in all these areas. There are Islamic teachings that can be derived from the Islamic text and offered to everyone. There are many things to be said in the area of Islamic government too. An important issue that can be brought up is Islamic government.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Government in Islamic logic is radically different from the common government in the world. It is not similar to monarchy, nor is it similar to today's presidential systems, to military governments, and to coup-based rulers. It is not similar to any of these. It is a unique form of government based on spiritual principles. The Islamic way of ruling is based on popularity, religiousness, ideology, and refusal to be aristocratic, extravagant, and oppressive. It promotes neither preparation nor acceptance of oppression. No one oppresses me because you are capable of counteracting it, and I will not oppress anyone because you are capable of preventing me from oppression. This is Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, Dua number 20. This exists in one prayer in Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah. Each and every word of these teachings contain important ideological issues. These are things that constitute our new weapons, and we must benefit from them.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Limelight. Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism, says Amir Makul, writer, in an article published under the heading Palestinians in the Naqab Face New Threat from Zionist Far-Right Militia. Stay tuned for more. After months of deliberations involving the Zionist regime police, the Be'er Sheva municipality, and the far-right Otzma Yehudit party, the Zionist regime recently saw the establishment of a Jewish militia bent on reclaiming the personal safety of the citizen. In the Zionist regime political lexicon, citizen is shorthand for Jewish Israeli. The newly formed militia is called Sayuret Barel, a nod to the Zionist regime Sayuret, or Special Forces, and to the Zionist sniper Barel Shamoli, who was fatally shot at the Gaza fence last summer. And this might only be the beginning, after the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett recently called on gun owners to arm themselves in the public. He said, "What is expected of you, Israeli citizens? Vigilance and responsibility. Whoever has a gun license, this is the time to carry a gun. We are also currently evaluating a larger framework to involve civilian volunteers who want to help and be of assistance." Unquote. The initiative dates back to October, when former Zionist regime police officer Almog Cohen announced plans to establish an armed militia to protect Jewish residents of the Naqab, due to what he baselessly claimed was inadequate police governance in the southern region. A call was put out for the registration of police volunteers who, according to The Zionist regime's media were to undergo special training in one of the three brigades. One specialized in firearms, another in surveillance and security, and the third in logistics. Cohen said the group was formed because of the loss of sovereignty of the state and the personal security of the citizenry. His comments echoed the words of Beersheba's mayor, who has said, if the regime would not carry out its duties, municipal militias would be required to restore security in the Negev desert. These developments come in the wake of a string of violent incidents in the Negev, which have fueled frustration among residents who say authorities are not doing enough to keep them safe. Ostensibly aiming to aid law enforcement, Cohen previously formed the Negev Rescue Committee, a far-right group that opposes the Arab-Palestinian presence in the Negev. Shortly after announcing the formation of Sayeret Barrel, Cohen was asked whether he planned to take the law into his own hands, to which he responded, "We will not wait on any bureaucracy." The group was initially supported by the Zionist regime's police and municipal authorities, but after gaining attention in the media, the police withdrew their endorsement of the organization, saying that it would not be involved and did not attend the launch event that took place on March 20th, but officials have not said they will prevent the group's operation. Notably, the police attributed this move to the group's funding sources, saying that it was forbidden to crowdsource for such purposes. But on their website, members of the militia say they were establishing, with confirmation and collaboration of the police, the Barrel's force named after Barrel Shmuley. For its part, the Beersheba municipality criticized police for stating that the municipality had launched the group as a residential initiative made up of volunteers for the protection of personal safety, noting that police had offered the group both legitimacy and supervision. The question remains, why did Israeli regime police withdraw their support at the last possible moment over the crowdfunding issue? According to a police spokesperson quoted in Haaretz, the decision came after it was clarified that crowdsourcing for such purposes is forbidden. The spokesperson continued, "The police welcome citizens wishing to volunteer as long as this takes place according to police procedures. The crowdfunding in this case was done through a non-profit group that also raised money for the funding of former Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's trial." Militias are nothing new in the history of Zionism. In 1980s, one of the most prominent such groups, the Hamas-Tiret, the Jewish Underground, carried out terrorist operations against Palestinian targets. In addition to attempting to assassinate Palestinian political figures, the Jewish Underground also plotted to blow up Al-Aqsa Mosque. What distinguishes Sayeret Barrel from such groups is its air of respectability and official backing. The municipality and police were complicit in its formation, even if they no longer support the group today. Palestinian rights groups and Knesset members should launch an investigation into the role of police in particular. During the uprising across historic Palestine last May, lynch mobs and terrorists targeted Arab neighborhoods, crimes that are typically treated leniently by the Zionist regime's so-called justice system. But the attacks were not limited to the far-right fringe, as the Zionist regime forces described the uprising as a new front that must be defended against in future, with the possibility of more intense violence ahead. In the case of Sayeret Barrel, the group's funding came through a crowdsourced campaign, which as of mid-March had reportedly raised 110,000 shekels, equally $34,000 of his target of 1.4 million shekels. At the end of the day, the formation of Sawyer at Barrel and the fact that it has received official backing at various times and in various ways indicates that it is not just the product of individual fancy. A sophisticated organization is targeting Palestinians in the Naqab and across all of Palestine, and its leader has encouraged volunteers to be judge, jury, and executioner.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, it's horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
ابراز همدردی و غمشریکی میکنیم با ملت جمهوری اسلامی ایران
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition